You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
How does one understand a monster? Is it a real creature? Is it a myth? Is it a metaphor for fear special to a certain group or community? Is it a product of the mind? Is it divine punishment? And what is a monster anyway? On Monster Talk, we've been looking at monsters from multiple approaches for years now, and in some of our upcoming episodes, we're going to take a look at how the very topic of monsters is engaged by science and academia. Because, like Argus of Greek mythology, to really get a good view of monsters, you need many, many perspectives.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long, bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. Karen will be back next episode and will also be joining us for our Monster Talk Live on November 21st at 8 p.m. Eastern. I'm excited to welcome back Stephen Asma to the show. He's doing great work in the monster space, and our discussion is extremely wide-ranging, but always comes back to monsters. I'm delighted to share this conversation with you and hope you find it and Stephen's work of interest. Check our show notes for lots of links to his work.
Monster Talk.
Okay, I'm excited to sit down and talk again with Stephen Asma today. And we last spoke in 2010, and since then, he appears to be helping develop what is seems to be a growing field of academic recognition for monsters. That's what we want to talk about today, monsters and how they fit into academia and culture. And as a reminder, Stephen's a scholar, an artist, a professor, and you can beautifully see his art demonstrated on his YouTube channel, Monsterology. He's also a musician and a writer, and his books range from monsters to cognition to religion. And it's because of this huge overlap of interests, I'm sure, that I keep seeing his name popping up in my searches for my own research. And it's really been too long. So welcome back to Monster Talk, Stephen Asma.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's good to be back.
Yeah. So what have you been working on for the past, 12 years? Good God.
Yeah, that's a long stretch. Still monsters.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, I've been doing other things too, but it all seems to be connected to the imagination, and then monsters always plays a big role.
Yeah. I saw that you popped up in a book that I bought last year. It was Jeffrey Andrew Weinstock's The Monster Theory Reader in 2020. It looks like he's collected a really interesting sort of what'd you call it? A survey of the topic of people academic writing about monsters. So what's your take on that? Is this becoming an academic field that's being recognized?
Yeah, that's a great book. And he's done a wonderful job of bringing together, like you said, academic experts, you know, from a variety of fields, all talking about monster theory. And monster theory has been out there for a while, but he really organized some very influential stuff. A lot of it originally came out of sort of literary studies and English departments. And that's, I believe he's in an English department, but also people like me, I have a philosophical training. That's what my PhD is in. I think he might have a cognitive scientist in there. So I think there's like a little bit of a groundswell. People are increasingly interested in monsters in a kind of interdisciplinary way. Like it's not just English departments anymore.
Well, and I think that's probably the right way to you know, it's not just monsters for me. You know, I look at a lot of weird phenomenology topics on this show. And I think we started out the show thinking about, are these things real or not? But, you know, after more than a decade, you really start to, if you really are being honest, you have to start asking questions like, what does this mean? You know, and how can I understand it? And, you know, it's like the old, you know, blind men trying to identify an elephant by touching the different parts. You can't really get a sort of gestalt understanding unless you have these multidisciplinary approaches. And I'm getting to that for everything. It feels like you can't truly understand anything from a single approach.
Well, I think I agree with you. And I think the, you know, there's a service to be done in looking at monsters, which you guys do. And it's a very important work because there's tremendous gullibility in the culture and claims need to be evaluated for truth. And, you know, what does science have to say about a particular kind of legend? All that work is really important. But then there's this additional work, which I think you rightly named as sort of phenomenological. Okay, why is this, you know, legend or this monster so ubiquitous? Why is it so pervasive? Why does it keep coming back? It's not enough to say, well, people are stupid and they believe crazy things. No, there's a more interesting story happening, I think. And as monsterologists, I think it's on us to try to figure out, like, okay, why do dragons seem so pervasive? And are there sort of, you know, image schemas that cultures keep repeating over and over again? And why is that? Are there evolutionary reasons for that? So now we're beginning to get some really cool evolutionary psychology looking at monsters too. So it's a kind of a fun time to be looking at monsters.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a sort of tendency within my peers to sort of be focused on rationality. And I guess the truth is there's sort of some limits to that because, you know, everything we learn in science is provisional, right? And as we sort of develop new technologies to dig into things and we look at, you know, look at the social studies replicability problem, I mean, there's all these sort of crises around what do we know? And if you keep in mind that it's all provisional and then we always have to just be adjusting, find the closest way we can sort of hew towards truth, I think maybe that's better. But, you know, sort of having a slavish devotion to this is real, this is not, maybe isn't that helpful. And I'm really hoping, in fact, I've kind of sort of pushed away from calling myself a capital S skeptic. It's still the way I view the world, but I've changed to calling myself a pro-reality activist because I want people to try to use the best tools they can to figure things out. But I also have to acknowledge that, you know, the vast majority of what we do isn't really built on rational stuff. It's built on our feelings. And, you know, as you say, this evolutionary foundation, we are animals, you know, who've sort of developed this abstract world that we live in that's not actually, it necessarily is part of nature because it's, you know, built from the building blocks of nature, but it isn't really the way most animals live, right?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think you're right. The tendency has been, if you're a sort of a hyper-rationalist, you know, of a sort of Steven Pinker variety. And I, you know, I like Steve Pinker and yeah, I've had dinner with him. I respect his work.
He's got some rock star hair, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. He's got the hair. But if you're sort of like that devoted to a certain kind of rationality, then I think you're missing a fairly important feature of your own really dedication to provisional sort of reasonableness, which is what you were talking about earlier. One of the things you want, like you said, is the best tools for understanding a phenomenon. And if the mind evolved as a predictive processor to try to understand its environment, then guess what? You know, scientific rationality is very late on the scene. And instead, what human beings have used for really hundreds of thousands and probably, arguably, a couple of million years is something like the imagination. The imagination gets sort of bracketed out, I think, by scientism as being, oh, that stuff's fantasy. But actually, what most people are doing is understanding their environment by using imagery and stories and narratives as templates to then move through what's coming at them sort of in real time and to project forward like what might be happening in the physical environment and in the social environment. And their imagination and monster stories are valuable.
I agree. Now, it's funny you mentioned that because I saw that you've written a book called The Evolution of Imagination, but I just discovered this last night, so I haven't had a chance to read it.
You haven't read it yet?
No, but again, these overlapping topics we're both interested in. I'm working on a book about the way we invent and innovate technology, and a lot of that involves abstraction is the way I've been looking at it. But imagination's a perfectly good word for the same process. So what is your book about? What is The Evolution of Imagination?
Yeah, I look at the imagination as kind of the center of cognition itself. The tendency, like I was saying, is to sort of split the world into, you know, rationality is basically the way we understand nature and it gives us science. And then everything else is sort of in the realm of values or aesthetics, ethics. And sort of philosophers made this distinction arguably around the time of David Hume, and it was really big in the logical positivist movement in the 20th century. But really, before that, philosophers like Aristotle and Kant said, well, wait, pay attention to the imagination. It's not just some fantasy dream machine. It's the operating system that connects the sort of sensual information or the sensory information with something like concepts. So percepts and concepts have to get fitted together. Otherwise, we can't think. That's really how thinking works. So how does that happen? And Aristotle argued there's some kind of mediating form of cognition, and Kant made the same argument. And I think now, in more recent years, there's a sort of movement that's called embodied cognition. And the embodied cognition movement is saying, you know, the way the body works and takes in sensory information is really important and constitutive. Like it has some role to play in how we think. And this is what I mean by the imagination. So what I'm doing in that book is looking, okay, how did image making, like how can we sort of have representations? Obviously, cave paintings like at Lascaux or Chauvet, drawings of animals that our ancestors would have seen in nature. How's that possible? Like how can we take images from real-time sensory information offline and then sort of manipulate them in mental space and then be able to sort of recreate them on a cave wall? So that book is me looking at things like music and visual art as a way in which our ancestors would have sort of handled and adapted to their environment. And my argument is that all of that precedes what rationality as we recognize it today. Like probably this precedes language.
Yeah.
And, you know, it probably precedes some of the changes in the neocortex. And I would argue that we still have this sort of, I don't want to call it primitive, but let's call it an original form of thinking, imaginative thinking, is still available to us now in certain kinds of art-making, you know, activities. So improvisers can still access this mode of cognition and artists can still activate it. So that's what the book is about.
Well, that's really interesting. My daughter and I were discussing this just a couple of days ago because I was trying to explain to her how that when we think with language, we're necessarily taking our ideas and abstracting them into sort of these words and sounds, which have to try to capture these sort of loosey-goosey ideas. And then we pass those along orally or written to other people who then have to take those same, you know, tools and try to turn them into a picture in their head to see it. And we don't always match up. In fact, I don't know if we ever 100% match up unless it's a really simple idea. And so we began discussing, well, how did this evolve? And I don't know, obviously, but I thought it was interesting because one of her first questions was, wait a minute, before language, What if you were blind? You know, how were you able to communicate your needs to people? You know, I don't know the answer to this. You know, I don't know if we have any records of that, but it's a really interesting question because language has been an incredibly useful tool for spreading culture. But obviously, we were able to share ideas before language. You know, our earliest rock tools I seem to predate language. I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's one of the key places to look is we think of language as, oh, it's a description of nature or of our, you know, of our inner states. And that's sort of like what I would call an indicative use of language. Like you're just indicating something, you know, it's like denotative. There's the cat, there's the dog on the mat or whatever. But there must have been, and, you know, linguists now sort of agree that there was a sort of imperative use of language before there was an indicative use of language. In other words, you have a sign or a symbol, like a grunt or a noise, and it indicates something because it has like what I would call like somatic content. Like what we now know about language is that it probably evolved as a way of grooming each other. So you see how mothers will coo with this motherese kind of like babble to their babies. That's not like a mother describing the world to its baby. It's actually soothing the baby by using these auditory sounds. And we think that language, or I think this is Robin Dunbar's theory, that we think that language emerged as a way in which groups of people, just like primates, can sort of groom each other at a distance instead of like picking the bugs off each other's backs, which is actually much more for social bonding and creating of like connections and affiliations. We started to do it with language. So I think language still contains a lot of emotional content. Like if I tell a monster story or a horror story, then I'm not just describing something that is fearful. I'm actually eliciting fear in your body. And that's the key to some of these symbol systems like language or imagery, is that it actually directly activates your affective or emotional system. And that's really sort of been forgotten, I think, by 20th century theories of language. But it's coming back, I think.
Interesting. You mentioned predictive modeling earlier.
Yeah.
And I think I got turned on to that by the book On Intelligence by Jeff Hawkins.
Okay.
And he wasn't talking about this in this particular way, but he was talking about the brain using predictive modeling and that a lot of what we think of as, you know, conscious intelligence is around that idea of trying to think of what's going to happen next and doing a lot of this abstract modeling. But it occurred to me, and this is something I'm still developing, you know, and as an amateur, whatever I am, I'm fascinated by the idea that these tools, these predictive models, literally exist as, you know, a physical structure in the brain, right? Like you develop them, but they become these elaborate structures of connections in the brain. And it occurred to me that if this is true, like if these models literally exist as, you know, connections of neurons, then when we believe something, in a sense, a belief is probably a kind of predictive model, like that it's kind of a way of evaluating the world, and that it's different from just like facts. Like, you know, we can store memories and knowledge, but predictive models around belief, I believe this is going to happen, and I believe this belief system, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. If it's been developed over time, it's probably a really elaborate physical structure in your brain. So just telling somebody something different, there's probably really strong biological reasons why it's better to like protect that model than have to develop a new one.
Yes. No, that's a great point. Yeah.
I can't really make much more of it than that right now. And I'm not in a position, you know, my day job has nothing to do with this stuff. But I am fascinated by the idea that there's literally a sort of biological cost to developing a belief, and that protecting that belief structure is not just about an idea. It's literally, you know, something you've worked really hard in your brain to build, and letting go of it, whether regardless of emotional content, it may just be physically hard. You know, it may be difficult. So
no, I totally agree. And I think that it's a sort of an interesting time when I think we're going to start to see more work being done on this. If you look at like the sort of Hebb's law, Donald Hebb was the psychologist who developed this idea that we then adapted to neurogenesis, which is, you know, what fires together wires together. And we understand that the brain creates these kinds of superhighways of information and then lets some of the connections die away, really so that this predictive processor can work more efficiently. You don't have to solve every damn problem every time you encounter it. You have these preferred stereotypical sort of brain responses. And I think you're right. Beliefs are going to turn out to have this kind of structure, which will probably be connections between symbols and experiences, like episodic and non-episodic memories, but also the motor system and emotions, like the subcortical regions of the brain, you know, the amygdala and the hypothalamus. And these things are all wired together when we're just basically remembering a trip we took, you know, to Paris a few years ago. So imagine if you've got a belief in God, or you've got a belief in aliens among us, that's probably going to be existing in the brain, like you said, in a similar way. It's going to be a series of sensory experiences and affective or emotional experiences, and then motor tendencies, like, do I want to run away from this thing or run towards it? And so when your brain and your body has built such an elaborate structure, and then somebody comes along and goes, yeah, well, the evidence isn't there for this belief, it's not going to be like, oh, I'm just going to drop this entire scaffolding, you know, that I've built physiologically in order to accommodate some little data point. I'm going to probably try to hold on to the scaffolding,
yeah,
and then re-see the data point as either an anomaly or dismiss it in some other way.
Exactly. And I think that kind of, what would you call that? Conservation of belief, maybe. This idea of you've invested so much in it, you want to protect it. Not even consciously, but just like your body wants to protect it.
That's it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it could account for a lot of the way we behave in relationships when we see erroneous or negative behaviors from people we've invested a lot of time with. You know, it's like, wait a minute.
You know,
are they really a bad person? And don't we all love to say bad person, good person, and move on? Because that's a lot easier cognitively, isn't it?
It is.
But it's like saying, no, humans are complicated. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're, no, shut up. That's too hard.
Right. That's right. Yeah. We like the easy bifurcation. Yes.
Oh, no. I noticed you also have a book out called Monsters on the Brain and the Epistemology of Horror.
Yeah, actually, it's just a really long article. It could have been a book.
Okay, sorry.
It makes up a journal. It's a big journal article.
I should have put in. I probably knew that last night and forgot by this morning.
Oh, no problem.
So is that something I can link to then? I guess directly to. Oh, it is. Yeah. It was in JSTOR. That's where I found it. Okay, so I can put that in the show notes. What's that about?
Yeah, that article has gotten a lot of attention. It actually got me invited onto Stevens's Vsauce show on YouTube. I wasn't as familiar with him, but my son, you know, said, oh, this guy's really famous. And it, sure enough, he's like got, I think the show, he did a wonderful show on fear, and it's got like 15 million views or something on YouTube. But that is an article about the sort of the stuff we're talking about right now, which is how does fear work in the brain, and how does the culture of horror sort of capitalize on those physiological and neurological structures and tendencies in order to sort of maximize fear or sort of regulate fear. Because sometimes what we want to do is amp up the fear, and we use horror stories and monster stories to do that. And sometimes what we want to do is down-regulate the fear. And oftentimes then, you know, if you look at going through a haunted house, you'll see that some people are like, yeah, this is really happening. And the zombie's really chasing me, and they try to amp themselves up that this is real. And others are telling themselves, this isn't really happening. This is just a haunted house, or this is just a movie.
Yeah.
And that's just a really fun distinction. Some friends of mine, Matthias Claussen in Denmark and Colton Scrivener in Chicago, have been working on sort of tracking people as they go through haunted houses, and like what is their style of handling the fear.
Wow. That's neat.
Yeah, so that article is sort of about that, setting the scene for that.
Yeah, we've obviously talked about fear a lot on the show, and I think, you know, monsters, I think that's probably the go-to thing people think of versus they evoke fear. But of course, they can have a wide range of feel. I mean, many people, you know, feel a huge amount of sort of sympathy for the Frankenstein monster, or sort of a weird sexual attraction to certain vampires, that sort of thing. You know, it's they're the bad boys or whatever. Yeah. You know, it's like,
no, it's true.
But I like the one I like the most is awe. When a monster evokes awe, like, it's maybe not so much in the original Godzilla, but some of those giant monster movies, you know, they, sometimes an image or a moment in the film will like truly inspire. It's like, oh, wow, we are so tiny. And I guess it's sort of that Lovecraftian cosmic horror, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. I'm with you on this. That's sort of my favorite stuff as well. It's harder for, you know, the filmmakers or the writers to achieve that experience of awe, because it just, it's not a experience that we have on a daily basis. Fear is fairly easy to engender in someone else. You just get something snarling and running at you, you know, the job is done. But if you want that sort of cosmic sense that things are not right with the universe, you know, that maybe God is not in his heaven, or I'm not protected, or even positively, awe is just that Grand Canyon sort of a sublime experience where you just feel small, right? You just, the cosmos is vast. That is, I think, an amazing aesthetic experience. And I love art and even entertainment that kind of triggers that. And some people would call this, you know, awe. Some people would call it wonder. Mm. And I think it's really an important, I mean, Aristotle said that this is how all philosophy starts, is you have to have some sense of wonder. And then it's sort of an interesting question. Is curiosity the same? Is it different? In what ways is it different? So, yeah, I think this is kind of a fun territory.
It really is. I think when I think about the sort of the kaiju monsters, I my son is a huge fan of kaiju and all kinds of monsters and Lego and trains. But anyway, he likes, you know, monster movies. There's lots and lots of damage and you know big fights between monsters. So he's really loved the sort of reboots. But my favorite of those movies is weirdly is Rodan. And it's not just because like of the Rodan monster itself. It's because the way they set the movie up, you start out with like a mining community and something's happening to the miners and you don't know what it is exactly. And you realize, oh no, there's like these giant sort of maggoty caterpillar monsters that are eating people. They're huge. And you're like, it's so scary. You know, it's like a terror thing. And then later on, there's the big reveal that these giant monsters the miners are afraid of are just the food that the Rodan eats, right? Mm, you know, and it's like that moment, like, oh no, I was scared of the wrong thing. You know,
yeah, that is. I mean, that's one of the things too that those films have been getting right is what is our relationship to nature. And, you know, I think if you look at the kind of science fiction and horror films that would have been made, you know, that were made in the 50s, our relationship with nature is, you know, fairly, you know, we're in a dominant position. After the bomb, you know, obviously the Japanese were sort of saw science and nature differently, as did everyone. But I think now these reboots of the kaiju are also sort of looking at, you know, the environmental problems, but also just the same old problem that's always been there, which is we're just one species among others. And we've come to believe that we're in some dominant position, but just put us against another species and you see how pathetic we might be. And so I love that about the kaiju. It just I love it about the Alien franchise too. These things don't mean you harm. They're not nefarious in that way. They're just another species trying to survive. They just happen to need you for food or to gestate their young or whatever it is. And that's a kind of Darwinian horror that I think was only possible after Darwin. Darwin was like, look, nature is not the beautiful, elegant design that Newton was talking about, where God had a handful of laws and everything's gorgeous. Actually, it's a messy sort of bloody feast of one group against another. And that creates a whole kind of horror that I think is really quite modern compared to other monster narratives of the past.
Yeah, and that's a good segue because the alien xenomorphs are, in a sense, they're kind of a hybrid because they always take on some of the aspects of the host monster that they gestate inside.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So in 2017, you wrote a paper called Why Are So Many Monsters Hybrids? And that's a great question. Why are so many monsters hybrids? And I'll put a link to that paper in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm not the first person to notice this, but I think once you notice it, you can't help but see it everywhere you look, is that all of those ancient Greek monsters, and even before that, the Egyptian monsters, and even before that, you know, the Babylonian monster, let's say, of Gilgamesh. These are all hybrids of some kind that you take two animals and you mash them together in the imagination, and you have a creature that's extremely activating or arousing for our cognitive attention. And this is a way of thinking about monsters really. I'm sort of interested in two levels here. One is to think about monsters almost epidemiologically, like why does a monster like the dragon, for example, sort of spread almost like a disease through many populations and many different, you know, historical eras? It's a really sticky meme. It seems to get transferred very easily, sort of horizontally to your friend, but also generationally, sort of vertically from parents to children and grandparents. And so there are certain monsters that have a tremendous popularity and longevity. And one way to think about them is almost like a meme that's particularly sticky. And why is that? And so the argument is fantastical creatures, like where you mash up two animals, really violate your conceptual categories of what should be normal. And when you violate them and you put them in a narrative and a story, it really draws attention and it basically takes on a life of its own. And here I mean sort of a meme in the way that Richard Dawkins would have used the term. It's a replicator. Just like a gene replicates biologically, the meme replicates in culture. And so I started looking at this and I realized, well, this might be one of the earliest sort of moves within the imagination. If we could talk about the evolution of the imagination, almost like we could talk about the evolution of language, then there must have been some early moves in language, like a deep grammar where you can put like subjects and predicates together. And so too, I think in the imagination, what happened was we were able to take a memory or a perception of an animal and mix, blend it up in our head with another animal. And that ended up creating what I would call sort of a deep grammar of imagination. So these sort of hybridizing tendencies within cognition end up producing a lot of early culture. So if you look at religion, it's filled with hybrid creatures. You've got, you know, sort of, if you think about Hinduism, you've got these wonderful hybrid combinations of different animals. Or, hey, let's just add arms and legs. If two arms are powerful, then Vishnu, let's add 10 arms to Vishnu. And so the mind starts to do these hybridizing and sort of addition functions. And as a result, you get monsters and heroes that proliferate like really sticky memes. So that's sort of what I'm doing in that article.
Yeah. So in 2019, I went to a conference called Of Gods and Monsters at Texas State University that was put on by Joe Laycock and Natasha Michaels. And it was, you know, it was largely a religious studies conference, but there was a lot of other disciplines represented there. And I presented a paper that was about a pattern for monster flaps. But in the process of researching that paper, I got really focused on memes and this idea of, you know, why do these sort of monster flaps become, and I really hate to use the word viral, but that's, you know, that's kind of the way they spread mm-hmm. out, you know. And I think I've identified some patterns there. But in that research, I realized that the whole idea of calling memes viral is a misunderstanding, or I think it's just wrong. I mean, because while we do sometimes copy ideas and share them with like close adherence to the original idea, it seems like usually what happens is we get an idea and then it sort of merges with our own material in our brain, our own ideas. And then what comes out is something new. You know, when you see people, you know, a lot of people like and share and without changing things online, but more fun is when they get an idea and they see a pattern and they make their own version. Right. And I think, I think the reason I pulled away from this in my paper was because there's a lot of baggage here, but it seemed more like a sexual reproduction thing where you're getting genetics or mimetics from the outside. You're merging them with mimetics inside your head and you get a new thing on that you put out, and that new thing has its own chance of failing or thriving or spreading or not. And so it's kind of hard to predict any of this. If you could predict it accurately, what's going to take off? Well, then you'd be in marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
But I'm just fascinated by the way humans, like, we have this compulsion to share ideas and change them. And I think there's a lot of interesting unconscious selective pressure at play there within this idea space.
I agree with you completely. And I think maybe sexual selection is the better mechanism here or analogy here, because you're right. As soon as you start to transmit, innovation creeps in, variation creeps in, and you're always sort of adjusting the meme or the image or the story. And that's sort of how all culture transmits. Like it's not a perfect copy. It never has been. It can't be because of, I think, the actual process of transmission. And people will sometimes sort of complain now in our political culture about cultural appropriation, but in reality, all culture is cultural appropriation.
Right, exactly.
Everything is mixing. This conversation we're having now will go like in my head and in your head in two different directions mm-hmm. later, you know, and then it will produce other stuff. And so variation really is the norm here. And I think that's right. So that's interesting.
Now, amusingly to me, one of the things I ran into was that so many of the religious studies people self-identified as Buddhist. And so it seemed to be, I mean, this is one conference, but it just seemed like a lot of those folks or there was obviously a lot of atheists too. I think one thing that can come out of studying religion too much is you go, oh, well, maybe there's all these religions and none of them are right. You know, maybe that's a possibility, right. but a lot of people seem very at peace with Buddhism. And I noticed that was something that's part of your life. How does that inform your monster work?
Well, I think there's maybe a explicit way that it informs it, and then a much harder to figure out, you know, submerged way that it informs it. I think the explicit way is I'm hugely interested in Asian cultures, and I've lived in China. I lived in China for a couple of years. I lived in Cambodia for a while. I've traveled in Bhutan, in Burma, Laos, Thailand.
All I can think of is so many wonderful people, things to see, the cult, and so many monsters. Good grief, there's so many monsters over there. It's amazing. I love it.
So that's one of the things that I like to do in my work is I'm very ecumenical. I won't just talk about the Western monsters. I do spend a lot of time looking at the monsters of the East. And so I've done a lot of work on hungry ghosts. And also I'm extremely interested in the animism that exists in Asia, which is sort of below the official level of official religions, mm-hmm. sort of like, you know, animism exists very much here as well, but it's really under these layers of official religion. One thinks, for example, about New Orleans and the way in which, you know, on top of the animism are sort of African and Catholic traditions. And so that's part of my interest in Asia, and a lot of this then in Asia comes out of the Buddhist tradition as well as the Hindu tradition. So that's one answer. But then I think, like a lot of people who were raised in the West and fell away from maybe their monotheism at some point, Buddhism offers an alternative that's fairly rational. It's fairly consistent with the sciences. It's quite different from Hinduism in that sense, which is really sort of a belief-based religion. In Buddhism, it's more like a kind of empirical approach to consciousness. And so I think that's what draws a lot of people towards Buddhism, is that you don't have to believe that the Buddha is a god. In fact, he says, I'm not. And you don't have to believe in the Dharma or the teachings of the Buddha. You just have to try them. Okay, meditate. Does it help? If it helps, then you're a Buddhist. If it doesn't help, then, you know, discard it. That's really the sort of approach in Buddhism that you find. So I think that's what drew me toward it. And I think that continues to be a major draw toward Buddhism.
I'm not super informed, but like I do understand that there's some differences between orthodoxy, the sort of like adherence to certain beliefs, and orthopraxy, which is I guess the actual things you do to demonstrate your adherence to an idea. One of the things that really impressed me at that conference was the way that the Yeti is perceived within Tibetan Buddhism versus the way it's sort of reduced in cryptozoology to a misunderstood, an animal. It's just an animal. But it's not just an animal. And I feel like cryptozoology is doing a pretty big disservice in the way that it treats Yeti. Have you looked at that at all? I mean, we're definitely going to do more coverage of that on the show because...
Yeah, I look forward to that because I know about as much as you just said there.
Okay, yeah. No, it's it involves these sort of mystical disappearing cities and all kinds of lore about these creatures that are, they're not exactly animal, they're not exactly people, and they feel much more like fairies, like or djinn to me in what I learned. So I'm definitely going to be bringing that back up on the show because the sort of like thousands and thousands of stories about people living with these spiritual creatures. And it's a bear.
Yeah, right. I would say there's an analogy here to the Native American tradition and some of the cryptids that we would recognize, whether it's, Sasquatch or Wendigo or Skinwalkers or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And I've become good friends with the actor Paul Giamatti. He's a national treasure, I think. But it's interesting that he and I share this interest in what we're just discussing now, which is, what about these sort of spirit creatures that you'll see maybe in a native culture, but also are some of the alien abduction stories possibly reenacting some of this? And what are the psychodynamics involved, and why are people attracted to this? So I do think there's a territory here that cryptozoology hasn't quite recognized. I do love just standard cryptozoology, don't get me wrong. I love the idea of thinking through what would a creature need biologically and in terms of evolution to survive in a certain ecology.
Sure,
I think that's really awesome work. But also there's this question about, is there a sort of social psychology issue here that really makes sense out of these spirit creatures like the Yeti or like maybe Bigfoot to some Native Americans?
Yeah, I think there's some strong parallels indeed. This is sort of territory that Jacques Vallée sort of got into in the UFO field with his book Passport to Magonia. But it's also territory that John Keel explored in The Mothman Prophecies and some of his work, Strange Creatures from Time and Space. So he got into the idea of ultra-terrestrials and also noted that these things have an incredible parallel to fairies and that kind of lore. And I don't think he got much into djinn, but that has become a big part of, I don't know if it's cryptozoology, but like this phenomenology, that sort of mystical idea of the ultra-terrestrials are fitting into this sort of cosmic otherness milieu. It's definitely out there. I just don't know where it falls. I think a lot of the cryptozoologist people are really, they want to be biologists, right? They want these monsters to be real animals. But regardless of what those sort of hardcore pelts and paws people want, the public, like where the stories live, they always embrace the weirdness. Like, so we've talked a little bit about how that the cryptozoologists may have a little bit of a tendency to sort of shave off the odd when they're writing their stories. Like, here's what they reported, you know. I'm not going to include that they also saw fairies and glowing lights and people stepping through portals and that sort of thing. You know, that's not as important as we saw footprints and hair, you know. So, and those other things are part of the story and maybe the bigger part. And they're certainly the part that seems to capture people's imagination. So,
yeah, this is something that I want to work on more. And I'm only just, you know, getting, you know, my fingernails in it. But it, I think that's right. Like, phenomenologically, you know, what does phenomenology mean? It means that I, as the subject, I'm having an experience. And the phenomenologists basically want to describe sort of thick description of the experience without making evaluative claims about what exists and what doesn't exist. Those are really interesting and important scientific questions, but the phenomenologist is just saying, well, here's how, you know, the blooming, buzzing confusion of experience is coming at me. And in that is going to be stuff that doesn't easily reduce down. It's going to be the odd, the strange, the what William James called the, he had a wonderful phrase for this. It was like the unreconciled residuum, he called it. You know, it's like so just stuff that doesn't fit in right. And you're right. I think then we clean up this phenomenological experience so that it makes sense according to our expectations. But the phenomenologist wants to keep that weirdness whole. And in that, even if it's the imagination that's providing it, okay, that's fine with me. It means that maybe ultra-terrestrials are something that we're providing because we have animistic tendencies within cognition. And then we bring that when we're out in nature and we see nature as animated in a way, as having sort of agents within it. Is that real? Well, phenomenology doesn't care. You know, that's an important question for somebody else. That's not what you're doing in phenomenology. Does the forest seem alive with agents? That is true for many of us. Whole cultures, Japanese, you know, traditions of animism, every Hayao Miyazaki film, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And all of us, too, have a tendency to read nature in this way. But I think it could be this complex story of how much is the imagination providing and how much is in nature that the scientific mind is not noticing or charting.
Well, I think it's very easy to think of animism as something those people do, whoever that is, right? But you need really look no further than teddy bears to see that we definitely bring a lot of, or as I like to point out, people who own cats. we bring a lot to those relationships that the other side's not bringing. And if you ever get mad and yell at your car, I would suggest that some part of you thinks your car is going to listen. It's not, but you know, it's a very natural thing to see motive and agency in things that have none, right? And you're right.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
A walk in the woods. You know, in the afternoon, it can be lovely. A walk in the woods at night, you're surrounded by something, you know, and yes. It might be your imagination, but it feels like the woods are alive, you know? So,
no, I think that's right. And I think all of us really have a tendency towards animism, and then we train out of it through scientific literacy. And that's a good thing, but we shouldn't then take a kind of arrogant view that, oh, only, you know, illiterate people and primitive people or whatever are animists. No, I think you're right that we're still animists. We just try to bracket it and control it out of, you know, certain kinds of decision making.
Yeah. I think all of this, as much as I love rationalism, I think it's a chore. It's not a destination. It's something you always have to be. It's like you're making up your bed or cleaning out your trash because it's not a natural mode of thinking. I think it's like a technology. I think it's a set of mental tools that you use to sort of evaluate things. And there may be some, you know, core rationality. It's just like there's some core mathematics, but it takes training and effort because it's really easy to slip into letting your feelings guide you. And I mean, Star Wars tells us that's the way to go. I don't know.
Yep. Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, I think the skeptic movement, and you know, I'm friends with Michael Shermer. You know, I respect the movement as a way of like, hey, people are too, you know, his view is, although he's been changing his view also over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, the traditional skeptic view is don't live by feeling states, you know, live according to rationality. And but you're right. If you just think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, the emotional brain is a problem solver. It's an adaptive, if you take the emotional and imaginative aspects of cognition, they've been under construction for millions of years, as long as there's been mammals. Human, you know, logic and rationality really only emerges after language, unless, you know, you could talk about some very core logic principles before that, but it's very recent on the scene. So that means that most mammals, including our ancestors, and including most humans for most human history, would have solved the problems, the adaptive problems of life, pretty well using imaginative and affective or emotional structures. And for us to sort of poo-poo that and sort of say, well, that all of that is ends up like with just the worst kind of superstition is, I think, a kind of arrogance that needs to check itself.
Yeah, yeah, it really does. And you know, I think it would be fun to have like one set of simple rules that guided everything. But you know, we I think our minds are much more like the console of a 747. There's lots of knobs and switches and
right.
dials. You gotta constantly be adjusting your flight patterns and you know all the. I insert appropriate airline piloting metaphor here. You know,
that's right.
Adjust your trim. That's all. I got it. Okay. So, but it's a constant struggle to sort of, you know, level those things out now, but I do, because we're kind of running out of time. I want to say, let's talking from the heart for a minute, man, I really love your Monsterology channel.
Oh, thank you.
So, I would describe it like this. It's you drawing or painting, you're using arts to present images while and talking about that process while also talking about monsters and your influences for the piece you're working on. But it reminds me of something I had forgotten about from years ago. I used to watch this show on PBS when I was a kid called Cover to Cover that was hosted by this guy named John J. Robbins. And then he was just an artist and he would tell stories. He would read children's books and make his own illustrations. And It was a simple little show, but oh, it touched me. Like, I mean, it was like, it was such a big part of me as a kid. You know, my mom would let me read the encyclopedia and watch PBS all I wanted. Those were like the absolute unchecked things I could do without any worry, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, to be brought up in a house that was very, you know, fundamentalist Southern Baptist, having some things where I could do it without being worried about the consequences was great. And so I got to see this guy. He was really nice. And he passed away in 2016. And I'll put his obit in the show notes because I thought interesting character. But your channel sort of evoked that. It's full of really cool art techniques. You're a really good artist. But
well,
also you're sort of sharing ideas about how this works and about monsters and big ideas about monsters in the process.
Well, I appreciate the kind words, and it has been really a labor of love. I started it when we all had the sort of pandemic shutdown originally, and it's really, I just thought to myself, you know, I really have always loved creating art. I thought I was going to be an illustrator when I was, you know, starting out in college, and then I started reading this philosophy and I realized, oh God, you know, I got to change my major to philosophy because I'm not going to be able to understand Immanuel Kant without, you know, a teacher helping me. And then it took me on this wonderful detour towards philosophy. And, you know, I've written 10 books now. But at this point in my life, I realized I felt this, you know, deep calling to return to art making and drawing and painting. And I have to say, it's way more satisfying than writing books. But I also realized, you know, that YouTube is a tremendous, I don't need to really explain this to anybody. You know, I publish a book or I write an article and, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds, eventually maybe a few thousand people will read it. And that's a success. But in YouTube, the reach is amazing. And so I, of course, still have very small numbers and I'm happy with the community that I've built up. But it's a way of really communicating with people. It's why many of us academics, professors, you know, we love this crazy history we read. We want to share it with other people. So for me, this is a great excuse for me to tell about the research about some crazy monster like the Hodag in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Or some, you know, obscure book by, you know, Borges, the Argentinian writer about monsters. And then also I'm doing images so people can see the how-to techniques and demonstrations. And when it's over, I hope that people have learned something, both like from folklore and from history and philosophy and psychology, but also, you know, maybe how to tackle certain kinds of artistic ventures. So it's been tremendous fun. I'm very pleased with it.
Well, I'm not one of these. I don't know why this is such a big thing, but there's this ASMR stuff. But
yeah,
I found I do find watching your videos very soothing as well. So
I've heard that too, actually. Yeah. The other people. Yeah, that's good.
So yeah, I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes so people can check that out.
I appreciate it.
To wind up, is there anything you're working on next that we should be looking forward to?
I think I mentioned before my buddy Paul Giamatti and I are sort of working on things, and he and I are working on some projects about the imagination, but they're still at the very sort of embryonic phase. But keep your eye out for stuff like that. Maybe a book project, and also we're working on maybe a little animation project too down the road. But also I think I would love for people to think within and without the university about monsterology as a way to organize study. You know, the humanities has sort of been taken over by basically concerns of identity. And that's important work, and I'm glad that work is getting done. But the humanities really should be a broader way of investigating the human condition. And what I like about monsterology is that it can bring in people from biology, cognitive science, psychology, neuroscience even. And that's a place where we could really be focusing some of our interests in the academy. You know, it's not the old, you know, canon, which people have sort of rightly critiqued, but it would be a great way to think about literature and biology altogether in a way that would really stimulate students and I think really help the humanities. So that's something else I'm interested in.
Good. I think that's good. I think that's really good.
Yeah.
It's weird though, because because of its multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary nature, where does it live in academia?
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
And maybe it lives in the podcast world. I don't.
There you go. We'll take it.
But, you know, stuff like the Monster Theory Reader, that kind of a journal that can bring together these cross disciplines, that's, I think, an interesting opportunity. It's an interesting, and obviously as well, and maybe more of this after the pandemic is finally over. If assuming that we don't all die. Yeah. So,
yeah.
But the conferences and symposiums, bringing together cross disciplines, is something I've dreamed about for years for doing, you know, just, I thought with Monster Talk, I could use it as sort of a way to do like a Monster Talk meetup and bring together some of the academic disciplines for that. And I hope I get to do that someday, but the more the merrier, you know, if universities can put together things, man, I would love to come talk or just attend. I think these things have, I think they have appeal to a broader audience than just a classroom or just an academic discipline.
Yes.
I think because monsters are something we all, or at least everybody listening to this, loves, right? So
that's right.
I think everybody loves monsters. I mean, we're afraid of them, and maybe sometimes they inspire awe, but they're a big part of who we are. So
agreed. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending your generous time with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it was really great fun, and I enjoyed the conversation so much, Blake.
Me too. So you take care and keep in touch, and I will send people your way. I'll put how to reach Stephen's work in the show notes. And is there any website in particular you'd like them to go to?
My own website is just stephenasma.com. It's Stephen spelled with a PH.
Yeah,
thank you. And then just the YouTube channel, Monsterology, is
absolutely
easy to find. So,
well, both of those will definitely be linked to in the show notes. So thanks again.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. You just heard an interview with Stephen Asma on monsters, academia, and art. Be sure to check out the links in the show notes to his articles and to his YouTube channel. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org
/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Accidental Creative, Clever, and When Things Go Wrong. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. If you enjoyed our show, please take a moment and give us a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps people find us in the ever-growing field of podcast content out there.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.